So what we meet in our meditation, it is usually our life. People that may believe when we come to retreat, we enter the meditation hall and then nothing is happening. It's just peacefulness and quietness. They are certainly mistaken, and people who may have come with such a belief, I am sure this belief is gone. Because what we meet when we sit in meditation, it is alive, with all its richness. And sometimes we have the tendency to believe that some aspect of what's happening in our meditation, which is related to life, is a mistake in our meditation. What I'm looking for is calmness, tranquility, because that seems so nice and to experience. That's really what I would like to be in, just calmness, tranquility, and joy. And suddenly what I'm experiencing is some emotions. Sadness, anxiety, impatience. And then I believe, oh, that's a mistake in my meditation. That should not have come in. I should have let it outside. So then I could meditate. Now I cannot meditate because this is coming in. It's like an obstacle that for some reason has come in my meditation. Which would mean that what we are exploring in our meditation is something very, very narrow. We would like to explore calmness, tranquility, but not life. So when life is presenting, I don't want this type of life, I just want a life of tranquility and calmness, in a sense a life that we experience very rarely. So I want to discover a life that I do not experience really. But the one I am experiencing every day, this is not this life I want to explore and to understand more deeply. So we treat often emotion in a negative way. Emotions are obstacle in the meditation. They should not arise. Like if in our life or in a human being, emotions were troublesome, were something that is not really wanted. We rather would like have a life very peaceful. But of course, this is very narrow-minded because emotions are really the richness of life. It's really what life is about. It is all those way of being engaged in the world. It's not just a knowing of the world in a scientific way. When we experience emotion with respect to the world or to other person, it's a way to be engaged in. So it's the richness of our life. And if we question it, it's quite fantastic that we have this capacity. That our life is not just a life of recognizing the sounds and sights, touch. It's not just recognizing, it's really being engaged. We are being affected, we react to it. So in this sense, the world being, let's imagine one for the time being, we can experience it in so many ways. The world is multiple because when we are affected through emotion, we experience a different world. The world seen through sadness is not the world seen through excitement. It's not the world of an anxious person. So in a sense, the world has, or there are many worlds just because our mind can be in many ways. We could imagine two persons meeting each other for tea or coffee or whatever you like to drink. And one has just lost his job and the other has just found the love of her life, you know. So the world is seen very differently. And I guess if they try to express the way they see their world, they are not going to, at this time, to understand each other very well. So for the person losing his job, the world is difficult and gray. For the person having found the love of her life, I mean, life is so fantastic. You know? Well, the world is the same, yet it is being lived or engaged in a different way. So emotions are really the richness of a human life. I don't know about animals, it is another story, but human life, it is such a richness, and yet it seems that we don't know exactly what to do with emotion. It seems that they are always a little bit cumbersome. They are too much. We don't know what. Even when they are difficult, like sadness or anxiety, it seems that we don't know exactly how to deal with them. They are really a big burden. Even excitement, it seems that is overwhelming, and we don't always know how to deal with that. And therefore, we may believe that emotions are a problem. But they are not a problem. The problem is that we are confused about what's happening. In the Buddhist tradition, it is said that the source of our suffering is ignorance. Something that I have heard so many times. But what does it mean? It means that it is a philosophical mistake, that I don't understand the world the way it is, you know, it has to be changing and whatever. Or is it on the contrary, some way to engage in the world which is confused? So the dimension of ignorance is more an emotional dimension than a philosophical dimension. So the source of our conditioning, the source of our suffering, has more to do with being confused about the way we react to the world through our emotions. We don't understand exactly what's happening. We take the vision that emotion give on the world, we take that for reality. We believe that the way the emotion make us see the world, we believe that is the truth. And there we are in cage, in a jail, locked in through the belief that the way we see is through an emotion, the way we see the world through an emotion, that is true reality. So we imagine through the emotion, we imagine a certain world, and then we are trapped in. And we look for the key. We want the key to this cage that we have just imagined. And if we forget to imagine the key, then we are in a bad situation, you know. Where are we going to find it then? So the fact that we meet emotion in our meditation is very important. It's a richness of our practice, it's not a mistake. Although sometimes it's, of course, brings some agitation, some unpleasant experience. But as we've mentioned many times, meditation is not about just a pleasant experience. It's not about finding a holiday in life where, wow, that was very nice. I spent 1 week, was so peaceful, not too much noise, was great. It's not about that. It's really about freedom. But not a freedom that is disengaged. A freedom that is an engaged freedom, that means a freedom in any situation, a freedom in sadness, in anxiety, in excitement, in desire. That's where we need to find freedom. If it is freedom when nothing is happening, nothing is disturbing us, so it is not so meaningful. What we explore in our meditation is to find freedom in any situation. And then it is meaningful, then it's not conditioned by the situation. Then we find that in any situation there is for us an attitude that is an attitude of freedom. If we don't fight against the emotion, if we don't believe that it is a true way of seeing the world, so in this sense then we can see that this cage that we may feel in at time is just an imagination. And therefore we are not spending all our time looking for the key. Wasting time, of course. So we could wonder what the mind needs to be, or how can be a mind that it can be affected by emotions. What should be the nature of a mind that it can be affected by emotion? How is a mind that it can be sad at time and happy at other time? It's fantastic. If we question that, that the mind there can sometimes just suddenly be sad, be happy, be excited, be anxious. It's so fascinating that the mind has such a capacity. But it means if it can be happy at time and sad at another, excited and calm, it means that the mind in itself is neither happy or sad, is neither excited or calm. If it were happy, then it will always be happy, and we see that at time it is sad. If it were calm, then it could not be agitated. So all that is not what the mind is what the mind can play with, dance with, is a movement of the mind, is a play of the mind, but is not the nature of the mind. Not what mind is, but it has its capacity. Fantastic capacity. In the Buddha's life, mythology, we see that before reaching awakening, when he was at Bodh Gaya, under the Bodhi tree, so what is just preceding his awakening? It is said that he is attacked by the army of Mara, described in a sometimes very powerful way. The army is of, I don't know, 20 kilometers long, and you have all those descriptions of demons attacking the Buddha. But when we get the list from what they mean from the text themselves, the army of Mara is desire, attachment, hatred, anger, aversion, pride, confusion. So it's not, of course, external enemies. It is just before awakening, the Buddha has to meet all those emotions. And because he can meet those emotions, because he meets them, then he can awaken. It's like if before he had met them, really, we'll see what it means to meet those emotions, then he could not be free. So whenever we meet emotion in our practice, it means that we are under the Bodhi tree just before awakening. It means that we had a long time of practice so that those emotions could come in. And it is important not to miss this opportunity. Well, it is to say the Buddha in the story had meditated for many years, so we can imagine that he had some capacity at this time that we may not always have, and we have to see how we can deal with emotions. I think it's important to make a distinction between mental states and emotion. We make a distinction here that it is a meaning we want to give to that. I don't know if in the dictionary it would be exactly that, but I think with respect to emotion there are a lot of views that are not all agreeing. So if we want to make a distinction between a mental state and an emotion, let's say that an emotion means that the emotion sees the world in a specific way. That is not an objective way, or that's not the shared way of seeing the world. While a mental state does not change the vision of the world. If there is sleepiness, it doesn't mean that the world has changed. Maybe it's not so clear, but I know that the world has not suddenly become unclear. There is no confusion about that. If there is tiredness also, maybe there is less energy in my body, and I see the world maybe in a less clear way, but I know the world has not changed. While when I'm sad, I see maybe it's slightly different. It suddenly is not so sharp anymore, it's not so bright, it's not so interesting. And if I am maybe can see it in another way, it's, on the contrary, it's too bright, it's too sharp, and I find it a bit threatening. So that the emotion, that changing the vision of the world, while the mental state does not. So in our practice, we can recognize that if there is calmness or tranquility, we will not call that an emotion because it does not change the vision of the world. And if it does change whatever it is, then we may call that an emotion. It's just so that we know what we are speaking about. Actually, the way to deal with emotion or mental state will be the same, but it's easier generally to deal with mental state than to deal with emotions. So the word emotion that we are using here, actually, there is no, it's not a translation of a Pali word or a Sanskrit word. The word that we are translating by emotion here, it's come from the root Sanskrit klish, which means to torment, to disturb, or the Tibetanese nyumon, which means also to trouble, you know, to make unclear. So an emotion make unclear the world. So that's an important aspect of it. It's make it not clear. We don't really don't perceive it in the proper way anymore. So it is clear that an emotion is a state of mind, is not a state of the body. Sometimes in our meditation, we are discovering the emotion from the bodily manifestation. Are not disconnected. The emotion also affect the body. If I am sad or depressed, I may feel with very little energy in my body. On the contrary, if I'm excited, there's a lot of energy. So it does affect the body. They are linked together, but they are not the same. Some researchers have discovered that for some people, when they drink too much coffee, they become anxious because they read this energy in the body as anxiety. Although there is no situation that would make anxiety rise. So the only aspect is reading the physical condition as a sign of anxiety. So they are linked together, but they are not the same. So if we try to be really intimate with our emotion through being more and more intimate with the bodily sensation, then we are missing something. Yet sometimes it's the way that we really get in touch. I may be aware of breathing in my chest, for example, and suddenly I find heaviness. Strange, it's heaviness. I'm slightly hard to breathe. And suddenly I find that underneath this heaviness, there is something there that is disturbing, and I may find there is sadness. So I touch the sadness from the physical aspect. But the sadness is not the heaviness on the chest, because I could have, for some other reason, organic reason, I could have a heaviness on the chest which will not be sadness. So now if you explore that, now I discover sadness. No need that I try to feel the sensation more and more if I want to discover what is sadness. I have to deal with this quality of the mind of being sad. This is way of relating to the world. So what is a sad mind? How is a sad mind? We know what it is. We understand. Nobody is mistaken there. For happiness or excitement. So we know what it is. We know what it does to us. But what is this quality of a mind that is sad? How is it in the world? How does it perceive the world? So when we start to open ourselves to really inquire into what is this being sad, not trying to get rid of it. It's painful, we know. If I try to get rid of it, then I don't know what it is. Maybe I can get rid of it. I may think about something else or something very pleasant. I may convince myself, sometimes succeeding, which is one way to deal with emotions. You can always deal with emotion trying to reconsider the situation by thinking, by seeing the situation in a different way. That one way we deal with emotions. And in the Buddhist tradition, there are plenty of texts helping us to think in another way so that we are not burdened by emotion, called using antidotes. And that's fine. And most of the time we do that. We use that. Somebody maybe has been misbehaving with aggressive to us, and then we discover maybe this person was in a very poor situation these days. So we understand the context, and then we are much less upset with respect to this person. But that does not help us to understand what is the emotion. So if we use that every time, we will need to use antidote. It's just solving the situation for the time being, but we are not deepening our understanding what is an emotion. So we can explore what is being sad. When I say what is being sad, what is this mind of being sad? What is a sad presence, so to speak? So if I don't try to push it away, to transform it, but try to know it better, but we saw yesterday knowing is not the proper word, to be more mindful of it, to be that mind of sadness. Without solidifying it, without grasping at it, just to be intimate with this mind of sadness. And then at times, sadness is just that, you know. Sadness is just to be sad. And then it does not burden us anymore, does not condition us anymore. Because we really have found the proper way to be within this, I don't know if it's a proper word, but to be within this emotion. When we find the proper disposition within this experience, it does not burden us, does not condition us anymore. And of course, this is not to be believed. We need to experience that in our practice, because to believe is not very helpful. We cannot try to convince ourselves, but explore, be willing to experience what is a quality of sadness, what is a quality of a sad mind. But connected, as I said, to the emotion, there is a certain vision of the world that we take for reality. So the sad mind or the depressed mind will see the world as being very dull. Nothing is interesting. Nothing is fascinating. And we believe that the way the world is. Although many friends may come and tell us, you know, they saw this singer is in town or whatever. They are all excited and we are not. We see the world differently. So we may also be aware which kind of thought pattern, which kind of belief is together or feeding the emotion. And question that. Is it true that the world is the way that I may describe it through my sadness or through my depression? We cannot convince ourselves this is just my way of seeing. We can think about it's just my way of seeing. Yeah, but it is still true, you know. All the other, they are just mistaken, you know. They just get superficially excited, but the world is really, really not so interesting. So it's not convincing ourselves. It is by seeing very clearly how we project something into the world. There's a projection of this sad world. There's a world, let's imagine. And we project the sad world on it, and then that's what we meet. When we see that it's coming from us, the sad world is coming, is a projection of ourselves, we see that clearly, then we know already the beliefs start to be weakened. Maybe it's not exactly like that. Maybe it is sadness that make me see the world this way. That's for sadness, but it could be for anxiety. I may believe the world is unsafe. Of course, it's not never totally safe. You know that. But still, when somebody is anxious, the way of seeing it unsafe goes much beyond any rational way. Anything starts to be dangerous. The leaves are moving, who knows what it is, and this person is constantly maybe on tense and anxious. So the vision of the world for this person is it's an unsafe world. Nothing is certain. Everything can be harmful. So we understand there are situations that are dangerous. We understand there are place and something can be dangerous. But then at this time with this anxious person, it's far from being rational. There's a projection of the fear that sees this world as completely unsafe. So in the same way, for the anxious person, feeling the anxiety, experiencing it, how the mind can be anxious? Through which magic can the mind transform itself and be anxious? It's so fascinating. What does the mind do to suddenly be anxious? It's so fascinating. And then seeing in this sense that there's a projection of the fear into the world that make everything unstable. And if one realizes this projection, then one can cut the loop in which one is, because of course if it is true that nothing is safe, then I'm right to be scared always, anxious. So the seeing of the world as something unsafe make the anxiety make the seeing the world unsafe. And one is through emotion, one is always, it's like one create a dream and one believe that is the truth. It's like one is being possessed by the dream one is creating. For whatever reason, for whatever good reason it may be. So, in some sense, we need to break that, this confusion about the way that emotion makes us see the world. And slowly then, when we start to question that, the world is maybe not as dull as I may believe it is, or imagine it is, it may be not as dangerous as I imagine it is, when one starts to break that, suddenly, maybe the world, in a more neutral way, in a more objective way, or let's say in a more common way that we share with others, may appear. And then the emotion may start to not to be so strong anymore. Yet we may be aware of the emotional dimension, of the quality of the mind to be anxious, an anxious mind. So when we can be that anxious mind, as a way of being anxious, not as seeing anxiety as an object that one could get rid of, that one should get rid of, not seeing sadness as an object that one could get rid of, but as a quality of the mind. It is not possible to get rid of sadness without getting rid of the mind. It is not possible to get rid of an anxious mind without getting rid of the mind. Yet, the anxiety is not what the mind is. It's the way it appears at this instant. The sadness is not what the mind is. It appears at this time in this way. But for that, there must be the willingness to be intimate with the emotion. If there are reactions, I want to get rid because it is painful, then I will never discover what is a mind affected by sadness or anxiety.
of it, if it's not the mind and it's not the world and there is no soul, so what will be the source of anxiety or sadness or any kind of emotion?
Yeah, I don't want to go into the source. I want to explore the present situation, how we deal with. We could explore the source. It can be reason for anxiety in the history of my life, you know. There can be many, many reasons, and that is a work of psychotherapy, which is a fantastic work. But when we are in meditation or in a situation where, when we experience an emotion, then our capacity, possibility in meditation is to understand the nature of the emotion. And if we understand the nature of one emotion, we understand the nature of every emotion.
Emotion is only a characteristic of the mind, but not the mind?
Yeah, it's the way the mind appears. Okay, I will try to give an example. Examples are always a bit tricky, but let's imagine that we are in Tel Aviv in a street where there are many shops. So there is a window there, and if I look at the window, there is, I don't know, selling clothes or whatever, but I can see the car going behind me. I can see the car. But the car, they are not in the window. They are behind me, but I see them. The window appear with those cars, you know. In this window, there are so many things appearing, but nothing is in the window. They appear. Now, if I ask, I don't know, the man, please, can you wash the cars in the window? He's going to say, well, I don't know. I mean, maybe you drank too much yesterday. Something is wrong, you know, and he will be right. So in this sense, The window is like the mind, and it appears in many ways due to condition. The car going here, and I see them. When there is no car, I don't see car in the window. So I am sad not just like that. I'm also sad because of conditions.
Is there conditions of the world or conditions of the mind or conditions of the relationship between my mind and the world?
It's a connection, you know. Maybe if I am, for some reason, I am slightly anxious and something happened, then anxiety will come more. Look, now we are two persons looking at this window, they may appear slightly different because our conditioning is different. Maybe one is more akin to anxiety, and one is less, so there are conditions. But we don't deal with that. What we deal with in this instant to discover the nature of the emotion. Because if we discover it, then we can see how we make it in a sense, how we're conditioning, and also how we may not get rid of it, but not buy into it. So we are not anymore conditioned. I'm not going to try to clean the window anymore. And that's fine. And I think it's even a richness of this window that so many things happening. Sometimes there's a nice sunset there and I see in the window also. Okay. But I'm not going to be attached to this window with sunset because, well, it's gone also. Okay. So we work on different fields. There's a psychological aspect of it, which is very important, but we are dealing here with a slightly different approach, trying to understand the nature. I'm not a psychotherapist, so I'm not going to speak about psychotherapy, although I speak about many things I don't know, but I will not speak about psychotherapy. There are too many psychotherapists here. Okay. To give another example how emotion works. So the emotion is transforming the way the world is seen. I got an example the other day, which I like it. It's the reverse of a chameleon. You know, it's a zikit. That's the only word I know in Hebrew, but okay, zikit for the time being. So this chameleon is usually taking the color of the surrounding. If it is in brown leaves, it will appear brown, and green leaves, it will appear green. But the emotion does the contrary. The emotion is green and the world appear green. The emotion is brown and the world appear brown. And then we believe it is this way. So that's why I say it's a reverse. The emotion transforms the vision of the world and we believe it is true. And again, it's a richness, but the problem is not from the emotion, is when we are stuck in. When we believe that is an objective reality. When we can really be intimate with the emotion, suddenly there is completeness or fullness in the experiencing of the emotion. Suddenly I can experience sadness. If I'm really mindful, if I am this sadness, not in the sense of I, there's just this being of the sadness, and then there's even a sense of totality in this experience, that I will not exchange this sadness when it's really with a balanced mind. I will not exchange it for happiness with a grasping mind. Because there's something that is completely free, that is completely balanced in experiencing of this emotion in a balanced state of mind. So you see, the emotion is not the problem. It's the way we relate to it, like in any experience. But we don't need to get rid of them. We don't need to see them as enemies in our practice or in our life. But it's a complex dance to dance with the emotions. But as I've mentioned yesterday, it's not just to recognize, because often in the practice, I recognize it is sadness, I recognize it is anxiety, which is already one step, because if I don't know what is the emotion, then I cannot really be in touch. So the first step is I recognize this is anxiety, this is sadness, this is frustration, this is impatience. I recognize that, and then I may start to open to really experience that. So to be aware, to be mindful, not just to recognize. Recognition is just to give the name and to hold to the experience through the concept, and that is not enough. Now, I think it would be also important to speak about desire, because that also an important part of life. And also, of course, they appear in meditation, and sometimes they can be very persistent. And in the tradition it is said, if there is desire or sexual desire, so one should rather seeing the outside of a beautiful body, look at the inside, which is usually less beautiful. So it's a way to try to cut the desire, which is a bit strange, I think. But I don't know. I don't know if it is so convincing. And I think maybe the problem in that, one may use whatever one wants, but is that in the desire, there is also a vision of the world which is specific, and the desire sees the world as happiness to be gotten there. There is really the way that it sees, there is not that a world, but is happiness here and here and here. And if I got that, then I will really be satisfied. That's exactly the only thing I need in my life, is that and that. It doesn't need to be a person, a complex. Sometimes it's just something very simple. As I was mentioning the other day, I saw a beautiful pen in a shop. It seems so nice. I think it's so nice to write. This I need, you know. If I had that, I could write so beautifully. You know, I want that, you know. Or a pair of shoes or whatever. This seems so good, and that would be so nice to work with that and comfortable or whatever. You know. Of course, sometimes it's more intense, especially sexual desire can be so strong. And now one can say that is just desire, you know, and try to be mindful with the desire and see the quality of the mind. And that's okay, but really I want that, you know. So now I try to cut it, you know. And, well, again, it's not convincing. Because the problem is, as long as I believe if really there is happiness there, you know, in this person, in this situation, if really there is happiness there, then I understand I should really get that. It's true. If happiness is there, then I should really get that. Of course, it's not always just a matter of my own decision, but, so when we start to see that what we project is a happiness and satisfaction, we project it outside, but happiness and satisfaction is an inner reaction, does not come from object. And that's good, because if this person is full satisfaction, all the world wants the same person, we're going to be in trouble, because this person appears, you see this person satisfaction, wow, let's go all there for this person, you know. But it's not that, it is an inner reaction. Luckily, so that we can choose different person, you know. because it is an inner reaction. When I realize that I am overdoing, I am overexpecting, not to say there is never satisfaction that one can get, is not that. But satisfaction would come from my own state of mind. I remember my old Tibetan teacher took an example, not very Tibetan. He said that, let's imagine a person receive, you know, a very small car. I don't know what the small car nowadays, you know, very small car. And so one person can be so happy. Oh, it's so nice, I have a car. And the other person was expecting something more, you know, from the father. I expected a big car, so the person is disappointed. And I don't want this car. Look at this small car. And the other, wow, it's so fantastic, I got a car. So if the happiness was in the car, everybody would be happy. But it's certainly not in the car. It is in the state of mind. So when there is desire happening in the meditation, it's important to see that what we project is satisfaction outside, and satisfaction is not there. And then we can start to be aware of the quality of the desire. But as long as we believe there is really satisfaction, then it is very difficult to be sincere in the way to try to deal with the desire. I don't care, I want that, you know. And I try to get rid because it's painful, I try to get rid of the desire. But when I'm going out of retreat, I'm running there, you know. So I just postponed it, you know. And then, so I cannot really explore what is the emotion. So let's see the way the world is being seen through desire. And this is quite easy because if we compare with one another, we see that where we place happiness is not at the same place. It's very different. So we see that it is not an objective way, and that's okay. Then now we can explore what is the quality of a mind that is desiring. And when we can really be mindful of that, it can be so much joy in this awareness, in this mindfulness of a desiring mind, because we are not anymore confused about it. So it's not anymore a projection outside, it's just the experiencing inside. So I don't want to go through all the emotions. But to make a small comment, when we spoke about the attitude in meditation that we should be open to the present situation, not reacting with aversion, I don't want this experience, or clinging to it, or confusion. And in another way, we also say that there's nothing that need to be transformed or changed. So what do we mean? If there is an experience within me, let's say a painful sensation, and there is aversion, so now I'm experiencing an emotion, aversion with respect to this pain that I am experiencing. If I recognize that there is aversion, I'm not going to say I should not react through aversion, and I want to be connected with this pain, and I just will do as if there were no aversion. I'm aware of the aversion, but I don't buy into it. I mean, I am not being led by the aversion. I'm not negating it, that's okay, there is aversion. I recognize it, and this aversion makes me believe that this is really the problem. And I don't believe in that, and then I may try to explore the physical pain. So it's not that when there is aversion or clinging or attachment to an experience, we try to get rid of them, but we don't believe what they try to make us believe. We recognize them, yes, that is aversion, that is clinging or attachment, and we see then the relationship to the experience suddenly change. Then it's very open, then we can really experience it. If we come back to the experience of sadness, then sadness is painful. So there's aversion. I don't want to feel this sadness again. So I cannot convince myself it is good. Let's experience sadness. It's so good. And then it's a flower, it's the Buddha under the Bodhi tree, and well, it's not so convincing. You know, it's still sadness. And maybe the Buddha's sadness was very small, you know. So I have to respect this aversion. I don't want to feel this sadness. That's fine. But I'm not buying into it. I'm not going to be led by this aversion. This aversion is not leading me, conditioning me. I don't want, yet I'm interested in really experiencing what is sadness. Because then maybe I can discover something. The curiosity, the interest is there that is more important than the aversion. And I don't negate the aversion. So I just need to say a few words about mental states. I think I like to speak about sleepiness because it's quite common and easy to solve. You know, if the problem in life were just a problem of sleepiness, that will be very easy to solve. So sleepiness also is not an obstacle to our meditation. It's also some aspect of our life. If I believe sleepiness is a problem, then I will react through aversion. I try to get rid of it. And trying to get rid of sleepiness means that I'm treating it as an object, as something that could be separate from myself, as a foreign body within my own mind. And there's a confusion. But if I start to explore what is being sleepy, then I may discover that I can be fully present, awake in sleepiness. And sleepiness does not imply that I need to be dull and there's a lack of clarity. But if I believe it's a problem, then it's going to be a problem. Again, it's not to convince oneself saying, oh, that's not a problem. Sleepiness is not a problem. We can be aware. There can be clarity. It's not going to do it. It's not a matter of thinking. It's a matter of opening oneself to experience what is his being in sleepiness. What is my presence? Sleepy presence, so to speak. And the presence is stronger than the sleepiness. And when we discover that we can be fully, clearly present in sleepiness, we discover something so important. We discover something about the nature of the mind. Tiredness, it's also easy to explore. So whenever something like that is happening in your meditation, don't miss the opportunity. If I'm tired in the evening and say, oh, I'm so tired, I hope it's soon over, then it's boring, it's painful. But if we start to explore what is tiredness, to really experience it, then I will see that is not conditioning me. It does not lead me to say, I hope it's soon over, I will go to my room. It's just okay, it's just a way of being at this time. And it does not conditioning me. It's not conditioning me. It's not something that I need to act upon. So mental states are also important to explore. Calmness, tranquility. I'm experiencing tranquility and calm in my meditation. Then I may enjoy it. Oh, that's so nice. Calmness, now I know how to meditate. It's just fantastic. You know? But then we miss an opportunity. Let at the same time, what is a mind, a calm mind, not holding to the calmness aspect, but to the being in this experience. And I may discover something much more important than calmness, tranquility, or joy. I may experience freedom in this experience. So it is important not to miss those opportunities when there is a nice state of mind. The same kind of freedom that you can discover that will be also so important when the mental state is difficult. So I'm afraid you have only 8 minutes left for sitting, for standing meditation before the dinner, but so please use this time and explore that.